So tonight's talk is on judging, exploring the judging mind. In the Anguttara Nikaya, the book of the sixes, it says, you should not be a hasty critic of people. You should not lightly pass judgment on people. One who passes judgment on people harms oneself. So in talking about judging, I need to be careful not to sound completely judgmental. Judging isn't antithetical to a spiritual practice because we need the ability to discern skillfully what is useful and what is harmful, what leads to awakening, and what is just a habitual expression of contempt. A discerning critical mind is a valuable asset, but it must be adaptable. It must be flexible and not adhering to rigidly fixed views. The essential mode of wisdom, discernment, panya, requires the ability to look at our thoughts, our words, our actions, and discern, discriminate. Come to a judgment in a way as to whether they are rooted in what's helpful or harmful, wholesome or unwholesome. It's only if we can make that discernment, that judgment, that we're able to then reflect upon our actions to see how we might improve our lives. This quality of discernment is distinct. It's different than the habitual comparing mind of where I take my opinions to be the most valid and compare them against the views of others, and thereby reinforce a concept of self and a division between self and others. Critical discernment does not assert superiority by disparaging others. So we shouldn't confuse being judgmental with wise critical inquiry or the exercise of good judgment. When I'm talking about being judgmental, I'm talking about being unappreciative, fault-finding, hypercritical, condemning, complaining, being quick to dismiss the opinions of others, having views that are strongly rooted in a sense of self where we're always comparing. This is unskillful. This kind of judging mind is rooted in aversion. And though it may be common in our world and in some situations except socially acceptable, it is considered a dosa state in the Buddhist tradition. That means it's a state that's hate-based. The exercise of wise judgment, on the other hand, we might instead want to call it discernment, is skillful. It's not a dosa state. It's considered an adosa state. It's rooted in non-hate and non-delusion. By exercising good judgment, we're able to see the subtle distinctions so that we can know how to improve our lives, how to cultivate the mind, how to learn and grow, even welcome criticism from others. Sometimes people praise acceptance as a very noble and spiritual quality. And you might be surprised to learn that the Buddha didn't really teach acceptance as such. We don't find it mentioned frequently in the suttas, certainly not as frequently as you'll find it mentioned by contemporary Dharma teachers, including myself. The Buddha instead vigorously and quite openly criticized his disciples whenever they made a transgression, even a rather trivial transgression. And he criticized the teachers of other sects that he considered to be operating based upon wrong views. If the Buddha was afraid to rock the social boat, so to speak, he might never have recognized the limitations of the teachings of his two first teachers and then left their communities and gone on to discover the liberating practices that he later taught. He set very high standards. He searched for complete liberation and he realized it. But the path of liberation isn't always going to be clear and it isn't always going to be easy. And yet sometimes it's in the difficult conditions that our practice really clarifies. Sometimes great beauty comes from the things that grow out of what is difficult. And one of the examples I use is of a time I was walking across the street, and although there were many different flowers in people's front yards as I was, you know, walking in the neighborhood, I noticed as I crossed the street that there was a tiny little flower, we might call it a weed, that had sprouted in a crack in the asphalt. And it was very, very tiny because it was growing in the middle of the road. Nevertheless, it had grown and it had the wherewithal to bloom just below the level of the asphalt. And it was exquisite, just exquisite, such beauty growing in very difficult conditions. And when I think of that flower, I think about many times when people judge others, not knowing the conditions that they're actually experiencing. There's no point in judging that that flower was small if you don't know the conditions that it was growing in. There's no point in judging a coworker for their impatience when you don't know what happened at the breakfast table that morning. No one really knows what's going on in another person's life, what they're coping with, what their stresses are. So we shouldn't demand that other people share all their deep, dark secrets and every nuance of what's happening in their lives in order to earn our tolerance or our patience. Can we simply withhold judgment? It can be our practice to offer kindness and good wishes without needing that sense of power over someone that comes with judging. How does it feel to judge someone? And how does it feel to be judged when you are judged? When you're being judged, does it bring out the best in you? Or does it tend to increase your insecurity or almost maybe want to fail? How do you respond to the challenge of another's judgment? Do you feel diminished? Does it feel like a kind of an attack that sparks a counterattack? Since judgment is actually classified like that, this kind of fault-finding judgment and is classified as a dosa state, an angry state, a hate-based state, often we react to the anger in it, and anger sometimes sparks further anger. But it's worth noticing, how do we respond to that anger that might be, or that that aversion that might be cloaked in a judging experience? Is there withdrawal? Is there shame? Is there anger and resentment? Is there fear? Is there the desire to please, the desire for approval, or to blame, or to attack back? Judging indulges these subtle, aversive, and arrogant thoughts. Whenever this kind of judging or arrogance is there, or the anger and the conceit will be present. So if you find your own mind sliding into habitual judgments, and some people do, they judge, that judging is a strongly conditioned pattern. And we may find that we judge thinking, and I mean, we note thinking or notice thinking, and we note judging and notice judging in our meditation. Sometimes it can be helpful, though, to just look at the forces underneath it, the forces within it, in particular, the conceit, the sense of self, and the anger or the aversion. If we let judging run rampant, it tends to close down communication, create discomfort in relationships create distance between friends. We all know this. We see lots of different situations. You know, maybe there's one brother in the family who doesn't make as much money as the sister, and so other people tease him or judge him, put him down. Perhaps we discover the power of mindfulness in our spiritual life, and we're so gung-ho for our meditation practice that we judge all our friends and family for their material pursuits. Or perhaps we've had a great insight into emptiness, and then we sit around listening to the mundane questions that other people struggle with and think, oh, I'm superior, they're inferior. You can see how judging and conceit are very related processes. Sometimes we don't get the attention that we want from someone. We don't get the answer for our question, or we don't get the request fulfilled. And then there can be a tendency to find fault with the other. Again, anger and blame manifesting as the judging mind. People often slide into judgmental habits when they feel insecure for one reason or another. When we're judging, we're basically relating primarily to our own thoughts, our own fears, and our own projections. We're not really encountering or knowing the person that we may be judging as they are in the present moment. We may not really even be seeing that present manifestation of the person, because very often our judgments are caught in impressions from the past. Maybe we're seduced into habitual judging easily, because it's just a thought in our own minds. It's something that we think we can control, and it might be a way of trying to exert a sense of control in this uncontrollable world. In the fantasy world of our own minds, we don't have to deal with the murkiness and the uncertainty of changing present experience when the judging is strong. Most untrained minds live in a babble of thought rather than the vitality and the vulnerability of being present with the flow of changing conditions. But angry, self-protective positions actually don't make us happy or create greater security or free the mind. Sharon Salzberg said, "If judgment were a liberating path, we'd all have been freed long ago." Usually, judgments say more about the person doing the judgment than about anyone else. And maybe that's why they're so seductive, because the purpose that they primarily serve is to reinforce a sense of ourselves. Each time we express a judgment, we are declaring who we are in comparison to another. We're asserting our self-view in the world. But usually, we judge from a very limited perspective and take that perspective to be truth. The classic example found in one of the early discourses, the Udana, is of a minister who invites a group of blind people to encounter an elephant and describe what they know, what they discover, describe that elephant. So one blind person is led to the trunk, and he says an elephant is just like a hose. And one of the other blind then is brought to the tail, and he says, no, the elephant is just like a whisk broom. And another is brought to the leg and says, no, the elephant is just like a trunk of a tree. And on like this, the blind people touch a different part of the elephant and thereby describe it differently. But which of them really knows the elephant? They're certainly each describing an experience that they're having, but it's not actually an accurate description of elephant. Similarly, how can we know anything other than from a limited and therefore distorted personal perspective? The elephant illustration is an innocuous example, but because judgment very often feels harsh and abrasive, mostly because we very often don't recognize the strength of the conceit and the unrecognized aversion that lies beneath it. I think one of the reasons we work so diligently as meditators, as mindfulness practitioners, to overcome the judging habit is because it reveals three obstacles. The first is the obvious patterns of aversion and subtle aggression that can be embedded in judgmental thoughts. The second is that chronic comparing that judging requires reinforces conceit and arrogance. And third, it reinforces attachment to views and opinions. And as meditators, we've probably all felt the suffering of these patterns and know that we deeply want to free our minds from their grip. We know there's no peace in aggression, in aversion, or in conceit and the attachment to views. We're seeking something other than the reinforcement of those patterns of suffering. For many people, though, judging is so deeply ingrained that it might seem impossible to experience anything without judging it, either negatively through fault finding or positively through praise. And somebody might try to soften the pattern of judging simply by shifting from the negative fault finding to the judgment that is finding something worth praising in it. But this, either way, it's still, from the meditative perspective, a pattern of chronic judgment that is still reinforcing the aversion, the conceit, and the views. So it's important as mindfulness practitioners that we look into this comparing tendency of mind so that we can loosen its grip over our perceptions. When we work with the judging mind, we might work with it like any other aversive state and be gentle because it can be disturbing. Because we're having to look at anger, subtle anger in our own minds. And sometimes it can be unpleasant, harsh to sense our own contempt veiled in this judgment or our own arrogance veiled in those thoughts. Judging projects our feelings very often onto others, sometimes through blaming or praising external conditions or other people. It keeps our orientation external and prevents us from really looking deeply at the functioning of our own minds. How do you feel when you are judging? What do you do when you discover the mind engaged in this process of judging? Can you be mindful of judgment? Know that it's arising in your own mind. Many people will use the mental label judging, judging, judging to really highlight it. The label like shines the light on it. It helps us recognize what is happening right now. Oh, it's judging again. I think it's important to do more than just recognize the judging. I think we have to investigate the judging, to see what it's serving for us socially, psychologically. Are we getting anything out of it? And very often, we are getting a lot out of it in terms of its reinforcement of a sense of self, even if that's a delusion. We wouldn't keep doing it if we weren't getting something out of it. It's important to look at how also we receive criticism when we hear the judgments of others. Sometimes they're requested, solicited, and other times unrequested. But there are no doubt times when somebody will tell you to your face what their judgments of you are, and sometimes we'll hear about it through gossip. Many of our weaknesses, though, might also be our strengths. It's hard to know when from the outside, is somebody stubborn or are they determined? Is somebody weak and afraid or are they gentle and cautious? Is somebody confident or arrogant? Really, who's to judge? One time I was traveling and the group of travelers I was with, most of them were friends and they were engaged in this kind of self-assessment process. And I wasn't really involved with their process. At some point they decided to make a list of my faults and inform me of them. And at first I didn't really want to bother with it, but I was encouraged to at least listen to their feedback, to let them speak. And then if I wanted, I could forget whatever it was they said. And I found it to be very instructive, not because there was anything that they said that I actually wanted to, that I wanted to take to heart, but because it revealed so clearly that the person that they wanted me to be wasn't the person that I wanted to be. Some of the things that they were criticizing as faults were things that I was cultivating as deep values. And it's so easy to find fault with others from a perspective that doesn't see what that person values and what situation they are coming from. We all do have very different values. There's a quote from the Buddha that says, a quote from the Gospel of Luke that says, "Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye with never a thought for the great plank in your own? How can you say to your brother, 'My dear brother, let me take the speck out of your eye,' when you are blind to the plank in your own, you hypocrite? First, take the plank out of your own eye. Then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's." Now, I began this talk with a quote from the Buddha from the Numerical Discourses, Book of the Sixes. And it said, "You should not be a hasty critic of people. You should not lightly pass judgment on people. One who passes judgment on people harms himself." But the quote actually continued, and the rest of it says, or the next line says, "I alone, or one like me, may pass judgment on people." Now you might be thinking, wow, now isn't that arrogant? Maybe the Buddha thinks he's the only one who can be judgmental, who can pass judgments. But the context was that the group of disciples were judging others and each other's spiritual attainments, the level of their awakening, and the potential rebirth states that others might attain upon dying. And the Buddha was basically saying, you know, they're not in a position to know that. They have not developed to know that. Are we really in a position to fairly pass judgment? Really, are we really? If you feel the urgent need sometime to tell somebody what you think of them, I think we should take a little pause and a few breaths and consider what is motivating that urge to speak. What benefit is there in asserting the judgment? Is the judgment creating any subtle sense of superiority over someone? Or is there any sense of wanting to condemn or create a hierarchy in the relationship? We have to consider also if that plank is in our own eye. Do we possess some aspect, some similar qualities that we are condemning. There may certainly be times when criticism and feedback is useful and might also be solicited. So before speaking, we can reflect on why speech and the principles of why speech. What is the reason we would be speaking? What is our purpose for that verbal utterance? Is it the right time? Is the listener really interested? Is it the time when they could take it in? Would it likely be helpful or would it likely be harmful? And is there any way in which our heart is constricted by aversion, anger, or hate? Or are we actually truly, deeply, and fully speaking out of a heart of loving kindness? When feedback is given well, it can be a great gift, but very often it's not given well, and it's a form of attack. So it's really important to deeply consider our intentions before giving others feedback, and to be sensitive to the relationship, because, you know, not all relationships are really based upon a mutual desire for personal growth. Some relationships are just about sharing a meal together or walking the dogs together. Often it's only a few relationships in our lives that we want to engage with those kinds of growthful, challenging encounters. And sometimes relationships are complicated, where we interact with people in different contexts. We might wear different hats, so to speak, where somebody might be our boss on the weekdays and a friend on the weekends. We have to be very cautious, very delicate, very thoughtful and wise in terms of judging and speech in these relationships. For myself, sometimes I'm in a yogi role on a retreat, and sometimes I go to the same retreat center and I'm in the role of a teacher. And what is acceptable is very different in the two roles. Sometimes there are both professional and personal dimensions in one relationship. So considering the context for our speech is very important. In the Susima Sutta, in the Samyutta Nikaya, Sariputta is corrected by a novice monk. And the novice monk corrects him and tells him that his robe is not hanging properly. He is not dressed properly. And Sariputta accepts the criticism and honors the novice as his teacher, receiving that correction with equanimity and humility. I think most of you know that I have been teaching the absorption states of deep concentration called the jhanas for the last 20 years now, and have written a number of books on the practice. And jhana practice is a system of such deeply concentrated meditations that are systematic. The first jhana, the second jhana, the third jhana, the fourth jhana. There are signs and indications of each jhana that one describes to the teacher. And progress through the system depends upon the teacher recognizing that there is sufficient stability within that absorption to call it a jhana, and then to move to the next instruction of going on to the next phase of the practice or deepening to the next absorption state. And this is all this kind of a systematic practice where it seems like there is a process that one trains in through and includes an interaction with a teacher, is always kind of fraught with the potential for a praise or criticism or judgment. Is the teacher being too strict? Is the teacher being too demanding? Is the teacher being too unrealistic? Is the teacher being too lenient? Is the teacher, you know, like what is the, there's a, a discernment that is needed that also involves or can be felt in the hearing to be a judgment. The first time I attended a jhana retreat, I was a yogi on the veggie chopping team. And each time the cook stepped out of the kitchen, somebody would start to whisper enticing descriptions of their newfound jhanic experiences of happiness and bliss and rapture, etc. Now, I think the sharing was basically good spirited on that retreat, but it was very unskillful. It was because there was so much comparing, so much conceit going on. When I practiced with monks as the teachers on monastic retreats, the style of instruction often happens in interviews with the doors opened, so that there'd be multiple people in the room at the time, and there would be people outside waiting their turn for the next interview, but still within earshot and could hear what was being said. A friend of mine who was attending the same retreat told me that he found it really easy to listen to yogis who were struggling to attain jhana. But he did not want to hear the interviews of yogis who were progressing through the deep jhanas with ease. And he told me that he complained to the administration. And it was not long after that that a white noise machine appeared outside the interview room so that the people waiting outside couldn't hear. And I thought this was kind of interesting and a little bit sad, actually, because I think if we can listen to other spiritual practitioners without getting caught in judgment of others or self-judgment in comparison to our judgment of others, and that whole dynamic of judging others, self-judging self, judging others, judging self, inferiority, superiority, the comparing mind. If we could just listen to our Dhamma friends without that, we could learn so much. But the mind can judge anything, anything at all. Punjaji used to, my guru in India, Punjaji, he used to warn visitors to not judge others, for if we did, we would have to be reborn again and again just to keep on judging them. If we're blinded by the belief that our judgment is right, we're taking our thoughts much too seriously. We're not seeing that the judgment is just a thought, a comparing thought. It's a conditioned pattern of the mind. It has very little to do with what is actually before us. Can we learn to recognize the judging mind as just judging thoughts and recognize it with mindfulness, observe it arise and pass within our own minds without giving more, without believing it, without giving more credibility to it. We don't need also to judge ourselves for judging. We can train our minds to simply see the seductive draw of the judging mind and to let go of that seduction, to disengage from that pattern, and to know it is just another thought arising and passing away. So I want to recommend that you notice the judging mind this week. Really see if the patterns of your own mind, do you tend to judge things as inferior or as superior? Do you tend to judge in the negative way, the critical way, the kind of the part that feels like it, there's really anger in there? Or do you tend to judge through praise? Notice that that's still comparing, that that's still judging, that that's still, even if it doesn't feel as aversive, but instead feels appreciative, it might still be rooted in and serving to build and reinforce conceit. And notice what happens when you just see that it's a judgment. It's just like the blind person touching the elephant and describing that experience, not giving it any more reality, not broadening it to be a statement of great truth. So I'd be curious to take a few minutes before we have a few minutes before our metta, just to hear how you work with judging. And any ideas? I'm sure this is not the first time you've thought of judging in meditation. It's a common subject. So maybe you have some strategies for working with it that you'd like to share. Hi, Deborah.
Thank you so much. You hit so many chords for me. I park in a parking lot on the property. I live in a complex, an apartment complex. And I noticed, I think last year or the year before also, this tiny little plant with these little yellow flowers coming up through the cracks. And I was just totally in awe that this could exist. And I always have to be very careful when I'm pulling into my parking space not to run that little blooming plant over. You just hit so many chords. I definitely have a judging mind, and I have gone to, I've heard Rick Hansen teach many years ago, looking for the good. So I have used that a lot, you know, what's fun, what's beautiful, what's kind, and look at that, and not continue to feed this other thread in those neurological pathways. But lately what I'm doing is just noticing, God, judging mind. And it's just like, oh yeah, the TV's too loud, or it's just noticing it and not paying attention to it and trying to be present for whatever else is going on that I should be present for. I don't know if I'm making good sense, but
yes, I think
I love that you talked about this, because more recently I've been doing this a lot. Just thinking, okay, there it is. I don't have to pay attention to it. I don't have to feed it. Mm-hmm. I can just sort of see it and go on my way. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
Mm. Thank you for sharing that. Thank you. Other thoughts on judging, how you work with it? Has anybody overcome the tendency? Hi, Mary. Mary and then Barbara.
Definitely not overcome it, but one of the things I've been looking at and working with is noticing the difference between discerning and judging, and how they feel differently within my body. And I really like the fact that you mentioned how judging can, I mean, it definitely has aversion, but I hadn't thought about the fact that sometimes it does have this anger, this other, it's got this real constricting, selfing kind of energy that can be felt. And it's really unpleasant, you know, to notice it. And if I can, what I do is I try and drop in my body and see if my heart is open and there's not a whole lot of selfing going on and I'm just trying to see what's happening. As a parent or whatever, you need to notice some things and not to say anything. If I feel constriction, just wait until I can just process it and say whatever I have to say with an open heart. But for me, it's just, how does it feel in the body? How does it feel in the body? And I really appreciate you bringing up the fact that there sometimes is this anger in there. And I hadn't really thought of that so much. So yes, really appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you. Hi, Barbara. Oh, unmute yourself.
Sorry. I do a lot of what Mary and Deborah do. I also try, especially if the judgment is sticky and I can't just dismiss it, I try to remind myself, this is suffering. And then investigate it in the way that I investigate suffering. Or I see someone else self judging or feel just seen in, you know, in the last few years, just how sad that is and how much of that suffering really is unnecessary.
Yeah, that's so powerful to look at it and to recognize this is suffering. You know, this is dukkha. It's really highlighting the First Noble Truth. Very powerful approach. I think once we recognize that it's dukkha, that it's, you know, it's dukkha, it's suffering, the whole spirit, our whole orientation to it just naturally shifts. Well, I think one of the, kind of the opposite, an opposite force from this judging mind is actually loving kindness practice. You know, it's loving kindness. It's with loving kindness, there's a boundless quality that decenters self from the perception of the of things, of all beings. And there's also loving kindness is an antidote to anger. So in both ways, the practice of loving kindness tends to diminish the judging mind.